We all have that one business idea we've been sitting on, waiting for the perfect moment. Well, Shopify is here to take away every excuse you have for not starting. Launching a business is a big deal, but Shopify makes it simpler by giving you all the tools you need right from day one. Want your brand to look sleek, modern, and high-end? Shopify's templates and AI tools let you build a stunning site fast without touching a single line of code. Even better, you don't have to worry about the tech side of selling. Shopify checkout is completely optimized the moment you launch, letting returning customers buy with a single click. If you ever feel stuck or have a question you're too afraid to ask, Shopify's built-in AI assistant, Sidekick, is ready to help you troubleshoot so you can focus on growing. You'll be using the exact same powerful platform that trusted global brands like Gymshark rely on. All you need is the idea. Shopify handles the rest. Start your free trial at shopify.com/gone south. I often talk to fellow creators and small business owners about how they get their name out there. And the secret is often the same: professional branding. Our partner, Vistaprint, helps you achieve that polished look seamlessly by keeping all your custom print needs in one convenient place. We wanted to launch a listener appreciation campaign for this podcast, so we used Vistaprint to create a beautiful bundle of gear. We ordered custom canvas tote bags, glossy stickers, and insulated travel mugs that look and feel high-end. It's amazing to see how affordable it is to get premium, custom products that actually reflect the hard work you put into your business every day. From picking the right item to nailing your final design, Vistaprint has you covered. Vistaprint, print your possible. Right now, new customers get 20% off with code NEW20 at Vistaprint.com. Remember, that's 20% off at Vistaprint.com using code NEW20.
Okay, so it was a cold, wet January day in Atlanta on January 16th, 1987.
This is writer Deb Miller Landau.
A woman named Lita McClinton was preparing to go to court, and she'd been in a long, sort of strung out divorce with her ex-husband, who was a white millionaire named Jim Sullivan. And Lita was a Black woman who came from a very powerful Black Atlanta family and was sort of braced for what would happen in court that day. And the judge was to decide a very sort of pivotal moment in the case where he was going to sort of decide on the division of assets in the ongoing battle. So she's nervous. She's up early. She's sort of puttering around her house when she hears the doorbell ring.
At the time, Lita was living in an affluent housing complex in Buckhead, one of Atlanta's wealthiest and whitest areas. Lita was the complex's only Black resident. She had filed for divorce back in 1985, and the proceedings had been dragging on for a year and a half. But that day, a judge was scheduled to address a pretrial motion on the division of property. If he ruled in her favor, Lita stood to get half of her ex-husband's assets. A friend had stayed the night to support Lita through the process. The friend was upstairs asleep when the doorbell rang.
And she putters downstairs, and the last thing anybody hears her say is, "Good morning." And there is a man holding a white flower box with a pink rose around it, and he pushes open the door, sort of pushes her into the foyer, and throws the flower box into her hands, pulls a gun out of his jacket pocket, and shoots. The first bullet misses, and investigators later determined that Lita held the flower box up to her face to protect herself, which obviously is a futile thing to do, but, you know, human instinct. But the bullet went straight through the flower box and into her temple, and she died about half an hour later at the hospital where she was born.
The murder made international headlines. A wealthy Black woman shot by an unknown assailant in one of Atlanta's poshest districts. But it wasn't until 2002, 15 years after the crime, that Deb Miller Landau first heard about it. By then, she was living in Atlanta and working for Atlanta Magazine.
I'm Canadian. I'm not from the South at all. I know nothing about sort of Southern ways, but I've been doing a lot of writing and researching into kind of Southern history and Southern culture. And my editor at Atlanta Magazine calls me and he says, I've got a really good story for you.
Despite the passage of more than two decades, the Lita McClinton case was back in the news. Lita's ex-husband, Jim Sullivan, now charged with her murder by the state of Georgia, had just been arrested in Thailand after 4 years on the run. The feds were trying to work out an extradition deal to bring him back to the States. Deb's editor asked her to write a retrospective of the case to catch people up on who Lita McClinton and Jim Sullivan were. But as Deb started reporting, she realized it was a lot bigger than a magazine feature. She published her piece in 2004, but she never lost interest in the case. She kept all of her interviews and files and carted them across the country through moves to different states and major life changes. She questioned how clearly she'd seen Lita the first time around and whether she'd done her justice. And so, more than 15 years later, she returned to the case. This time, she wanted to write the full story and what it meant to the city of Atlanta. To do so, she had to go back to the beginning. I'm Jed Lipinski. This is Gone South. When Deb Landau set out to write the full story of the Lita McClinton case, she knew she had her work cut out for her. As a white woman from Canada, she questioned whether she'd ever fully understand what it meant to be Lita, a black woman at the heart of Atlanta's black elite in the 70s and 80s.
So when I started to look into who the McClintons were, it was really interesting to me because it opened my eyes to a lot of parts of the culture that I just wasn't aware of.
Lita McClinton was born in January 1952 and grew up on Atlanta's West Side, a neighborhood that had shifted from white to black as whites fled to the suburbs. In their wake, a new Atlanta was taking shape, one with black mayors, black-owned businesses, and a thriving black professional class. By the 1970s, people were calling it the Black Mecca.
So Lita's parents, Emery and Joanne McClinton, they met when they were in the fourth grade. They were both very, very educated, very, very involved in their neighborhood politics and in national politics and the civil rights movement as well. They were surrounded by neighbors who went to HBCUs like they did, like Clark or Morehouse or Spelman, which were all HBCUs right in the middle of Atlanta. And they sat around and talked about really heady issues like civil rights and school desegregation and what were civil rights in the first place.
Lita was the oldest of the McClintons' three children. But while their household was politically progressive, the world outside was a very different place.
They're growing up at a time when restaurants had two separate entrances, one for whites, one for coloreds. And in the first 20 years of Lita's life, she saw dramatic shifts in what was happening in the world around her. You know, she saw the passing of Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, which led to the desegregations of schools. She saw the passing of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And then she saw the passing of Loving versus Virginia, which was a Supreme Court ruling that said that states' anti-miscegenation laws that banned marriage between whites and blacks or individuals of different races was unconstitutional.
Lita graduated from Spelman College in 1974. She was bright and popular and ambitious. Her parents expected her to follow in their footsteps and pursue a career as a civil servant. But she took another path.
Her big thing was fashion. So she started working at a boutique in one of the upscale malls in Atlanta. And on a sort of meaningful day in 1976, a white man walks into the boutique and is absolutely taken by Lita. And she says, you know, how can I help you? And that was a moment that would change her life.
So tell me about this guy who walked in that day, Jim Sullivan, and who he was.
So Jim was 10 years older than Lita. He was white. He was from Boston, so he had a very strong New England accent. When she met him, he was kind of quirky. He wore, you know, weird clothes and, you know, disheveled hair and glasses that didn't look good on him. And Jim had moved to Macon, Georgia, which is about 80 miles south of Atlanta, because he had inherited his uncle's liquor distributorship in Macon. And really soon after he came to join his uncle to help with his business, the uncle dropped dead, which left the entire business and most of the uncle's possessions to Jim. So he was sort of an overnight millionaire living in Macon, which is very Southern, very conservative. And he's this brash New Englander with a kind of quirky style. And that's where he's at when he comes in and meets Lita. And sort of almost right off the bat, you know, kind of we'd call it love bombing today, just, you know, absolutely buys her all sorts of gifts and showers her with attention. And you're like nobody I've ever met before. And the two, despite their very different sort of upbringings and very different age difference and the race difference, kind of really fall hard for each other.
But Lita's parents didn't like Jim. They found him arrogant and crude, not the type of guy they wanted for their daughter. They also understood the hardships Lita would face as a black woman with a wealthy white man. Again, it had been less than a decade since the Supreme Court struck down laws banning interracial marriage, and it was still rare to see interracial couples, especially in the South.
Just about less than a year after they meet, he proposes, and she sort of tells her parents, and, you know, which rankles them because, you know, it would have been better etiquette for him to ask her family or her dad for his daughter's hand. So it was just a lot of really, really big red flags in the beginning, but also Lita's family, they are open-minded and loving people, and they thought, you know, this is what our daughter wants. We have to figure out a way to support her.
Then, the night before the wedding, Jim dropped a bomb on Lita. Actually, it was two bombs. First, he asked her to sign a prenup. Second, he let Lita know, for the first time, that he had four kids and an ex-wife back in Boston.
And this is sort of, you know, the biggest bombshell of all, because the one thing that they have in common is their Catholic beliefs. And so, you know, the fact that he's divorced and the fact that he has children and she doesn't know anything about it is astounding. But as we all know, when you've got your love blinders on, you'll do all sorts of crazy things. And so she tells her parents all about it. They're absolutely dumbfounded and enraged and like, you know, you can't go through with this, but she does. So Jim and Lita get married in December of 1976.
To Lita's parents, the marriage seemed doomed from the start, but Lita couldn't see it. It would take a few years for her to understand who she'd actually married.
Hey gang, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and we are gonna move. We are gonna answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
For the first year and a half of Lita's marriage to Jim, Lita stayed in Atlanta. She was part of a retail buyers program for a major department store in town. Jim, meanwhile, was down in Macon, an hour and a half away. But he eventually convinced her to leave her friends and family and move in with him.
So when she finally does move there, they buy a house in Shirley Hills, which is an extremely white, wealthy neighborhood in Macon. I think about it sometimes and I think, like, well, couldn't they have, you know, bought something a little bit more modest in a place that had a little bit more diversity? But it was Jim's way. It was sort of like, I want to show that I can bring my black wife to Shirley Hills and the rest of you be damned.
Lita had grown up navigating elite white spaces in Atlanta, and she knew how to handle herself. But she struggled to adapt to life in Macon.
At one point, people throw garbage on their doorstep, and she's sort of frozen out of any kind of social events and, you know, sort of tisk-tisked by the society ladies. And for a while, it actually kind of brings Jim and Lita together. You know, it's like them against the world. And they end up making a few friends, including a couple of white neighbors. And she gets very involved in local charities, and they sponsor a woman who is a black woman in the Miss Macon beauty contest. And, you know, they start to sort of make their way in Macon. And for a while, it's, you know, they're having fun. They're wealthy. They're a young couple who has a lot of love and lust for each other. And they do a lot of traveling and things are good. in Macon in the beginning.
But it didn't take long for that to change. As the honeymoon phase wore off, Jim became a different man. His moods darkened. He started staying away from the house for long periods, and he became paranoid about money. He didn't want Lita to work, but he gave her only a small allowance and deducted household expenses from it.
Soon she starts to believe that he's sleeping with other women, and she accuses him, and they kind of get into this whole cycle that becomes this sort of cycle of gaslighting and rinse and repeat. He denies that he's having affairs, then he admits it, then he buys her some sort of expensive jewelry or gives her money as an apology, and round they go.
In her years of reporting on the case, Deb spoke extensively to Lita's parents, her friends, and the people closest to her, piecing together Lita's state of mind in the final years of her marriage.
And Lita's feeling terrified. She feels like she's failing as a wife. She feels like she doesn't know how to bring him back and get the spark back. Then one day, out of the blue, you know, this is a few years after they're married, Jim announces that he's sold the business and that he's purchased a $2 million mansion in Palm Beach, Florida, all without telling Lita.
Jim Sullivan bought the house in Palm Beach in 1983. They'd been married for 7 years by this point. Lita had only just acclimated to Macon when she found herself in a brand new world of wealth and privilege.
Palm Beach is like an island that's separated between the Intracoastal Waterway and the Atlantic Ocean. It's sort of a world unto its own. And this is where Jeffrey Epstein lived. This is where Mar-a-Lago is. This is where Bernie Madoff lives. It is an extraordinarily affluent part of the world. And it sort of runs on this system of where are you from, how much wealth do you have really matters.
Not long after Lita and Jim moved to Palm Beach, the Miami Herald published an expose on the culture of the island's golf, tennis, and yacht clubs. The unspoken rule, the paper concluded, was that if you're not white, you're not welcome.
The population is 99.9% white. And, you know, the probably 0.1% is live in maids or nannies or something. The only black and brown people you see, even to this day, generally, is the gardeners or landscapers working in the lawn. So, you know, that's the situation that they're moving to.
The house Jim bought was a 17,000 square foot mansion called Casa Aleda. It had 17 rooms and a tunnel that went underneath South Ocean Boulevard to its own private beach. Just as the move to Macon had done years earlier, the excitement of a new life together papered over the cracks in their marriage.
They're now buying things for the house. They're decorating this mansion. They're exploring this whole new world. But it does not take long before they realize that Lita is serious ballast to Jim's social aspirations. You know, he's not going to get very far in that world with a black wife. And Lita, who's got more pedigree and more sophistication than Jim does, is now feeling like a second-class citizen even more than she did before.
As she had in Macon, Lita struggled to find her way in Palm Beach. Despite her bubbly personality, she had trouble making friends. She'd always wanted kids, but she discovered she was unable to. She leaned on friends and family who came to visit from Atlanta. Jim, meanwhile, was as inscrutable as ever. He'd complain about Lita turning on the AC, but then he went out and bought a Rolls Royce. And as Lita noticed, he began eyeing other women.
So things are going south in Palm Beach really quickly, and Lita sort of somehow convinces Jim to buy a condo in Atlanta so she can escape. So she starts spending more and more time at this condo that he buys. And for him, it's great because it allows him to sort of pick up where he wants to be in doing all the things that he wants to do in Palm Beach, including, you know, he goes and schmoozes every woman that he meets, and he's kind of becomes infatuated with this woman named Suki. Suki's a Korean-born sort of socialite who has learned that if she can hitch her wagon to wealthy white men, she's got it made and has done so several times. And so she and Jim are kind of fooling around on the side.
On a summer day in 1985, Lita came back to Palm Beach from Atlanta to find a woman's lingerie in the master bed. As Deb puts it, it was the bra that broke the camel's back.
it was the sort of thing that just was it. That was it. And suddenly she realizes, like, I'm not doing this anymore. She rents a U-Haul trailer when Jim's out of town. She hitches it to her Mercedes and drives the 600 miles to Atlanta, and 2 days later files for divorce.
Lita had finally gotten away from Jim Sullivan, but Jim was not the kind of guy who let things go.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
Most violent crimes that capture the public's imagination seem larger than life, but sometimes the most terrifying criminals are right next door.
And he's just yelling, "Mataron a mi hijo," which translates to, "They killed my son."
On the Fear Thy Neighbor podcast from ID, we'll explore these true stories and hear what happens when neighborly disputes reach the point of no return.
What do you want?
Just this.
Listen to Fear Thy Neighbor wherever you get your podcasts.
After close to 10 years of marriage, Lita McClinton filed for divorce from her husband, Jim Sullivan, in 1985. But in keeping with Jim's personality, he fought it. During their relationship, he'd used his legal and financial resources to make sure everything was in his name and that Lita had nothing.
Jim has arranged it so he has had, over the years, Lita sign a post-nuptial agreement that was designed in sort of theory to give her more financial freedom, but in fact, it gives her less. And he's made sure that all of the homes that they own, all of the jewelry that he's given to Lita as sort of apologies, is all in his name. And he is the only one who knows where the deeds are. He hides the jewelry in a safe. The cars are owned by him. All the belongings everywhere are owned by him.
Jim tried to get the divorce litigated in Florida because he thought a Florida judge would favor him. But that didn't happen, and the divorce played out in Georgia instead.
And so she doesn't have much, and all she wants is the Atlanta condo and money to live off of and her, by this point, 12-year-old car. But he just sees red and can't understand how she would be deserving of any of his wealth, you know, after 10 years of marriage. He turns off the power at the Atlanta house. He shuts off the insurance on her car. He stops paying legal fees. A judge orders him to pay Lita a monthly stipend, and he stops paying that. So she's got to borrow money from her family, and she's just trying to get through it.
But there was cause for hope. In Georgia, asset division in a divorce is decided by a jury, not a judge. And Lita's attorney thought a jury would be more sympathetic to her than a judge would be.
And so Jim can feel it coming. You know, he's getting more and more panicked. He's starting to run out of money. He wants to move on with his life with his mistress, Suki. And so he's pushing. So they get to January 16th, 1987. This is when the judge is supposed to make a pivotal decision on whether or not the case will go to a jury. And by all accounts, it's likely to go in Lita's favor. But they never make it to court.
Lita was murdered that morning. Her family was in a state of shock, and they knew Jim had something to do with it.
Lita's funeral is overflowing into the streets. People from all over the country are there, her Spelman College friends, all the people that the McClintons know. And the one person who isn't there is Jim.
The cops knew Jim was a prime suspect, but he had a strong alibi. He was at their Palm Beach mansion when Lita was killed in Atlanta. And in his interviews with the police, he did his best to cloud the investigation. He claimed Lita was on drugs and that she was having extramarital affairs with suspicious men.
And so the police kind of believe him. I mean, he's this charming New Englander. He's got a solid alibi. He was, you know, 600 miles away in Florida. And, you know, there's nothing that they've found that can connect him. So he remains the lead suspect. But he sends them off in all sorts of different directions. And, you know, 8 months later, he marries Suki and basically sort of goes on with his life.
But the investigation didn't end with Jim. The morning of the murder, neighbors had seen a man running from Lita's complex and gave police a basic description. Investigators also traced the flowers back to a local shop where the owner remembered the man who'd bought them. The descriptions didn't match each other, so with the aid of other witnesses, the cops concluded that three men were involved and that the murder was most likely a hit.
But it was a sloppy hit. So usually, you know, if you hire a hitman, they'll use a gun that is untraceable and leave it at the scene. They'll make sure that nobody else is in the house. And of course, Lita's friend and her daughter are hiding upstairs when she's murdered. There are bullet fragments found at the scene, but no gun. So they feel like they've got sort of an idea of what happened, that there was a hit team that came and that potentially Jim had something to do with it. But for a long time, they can't find anything that connects him to the murder.
But then, another break sent the cops in a different direction. While examining Jim Sullivan's phone records, an Atlanta police detective named Welcome Harris made a startling discovery. He noticed that less than an hour after the murder, someone had placed a collect call to Jim's house in Palm Beach.
So he calls the number. Nobody answers, calls again, calls again, calls again. Finally, somebody's like, hello. He can hear traffic in the background and stuff. And Detective Harris says, you know, where is this? Who am I calling? This is, you know, long before the days of caller ID and things. And the guy goes, oh, I'm just picked up the phone at a rest area. And it's in Sewanee, Georgia.
In other words, when Detective Harris called the number, a random stranger at the rest area had picked up the ringing payphone. As it happened, Harris knew the location. It was close to the Atlanta Falcons football training camp. The call had been placed about 40 minutes after the time of the murder, so Harris got in his squad car and drove the distance from Lita's townhouse to the rest area. Sure enough, the drive took about 40 minutes.
So he's excited. Like, this is a huge connection to Jim, you know, having something to do with it. So he and a couple other cops go down to Florida and question Jim about this phone call from this rest area. And Jim says, you know, there's lots of maids in the house. Maybe one of them answered it. I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe it was a wrong number. And so they quickly realize that they can't prove that Jim actually took the call or anything. So they need more.
It was around this time that the feds got involved. A few years earlier, Congress had enacted a new federal murder for hire statute. Basically, the law says that if you use any means of interstate commerce, a phone call, wire transfer, mail, and later the internet, to arrange or carry out a murder for hire, it becomes a federal crime. The fact that someone had placed an interstate call from Sewanee, Georgia to Jim's house in Palm Beach meant that the FBI could take over the case from Atlanta police. Back in the 80s, local cops had a lot fewer tools than they have today. They could pull basic call logs, but not much more. The FBI could go a lot deeper. They could cross-reference calls across different jurisdictions, and they could force phone companies to reveal not just when the calls were made, but who made them. The FBI assigned an investigator named Special Agent John Kingston to the case. It didn't take long for him to find some more suspicious calls.
And so he combs through the phone records again and finds that in the days leading up to the murder, Jim had a series of telephone calls between Howard Johnson's hotel in Atlanta and Jim's house.
Of course, Kingston didn't know what was said in those calls. But as Deb put it, he knew enough about Jim Sullivan at this point to know he wasn't a Howard Johnson's kind of guy. So he drove up to the Howard Johnson's in question himself and asked to look through the hotel's guest records from back in January 1987.
And he miraculously finds a piece of paper that says 3 days before the murder that three men checked into the Howard Johnson's and were driving a white Toyota.
By this point, investigators had learned that the man who'd bought the flowers had also been driving a white Toyota.
So he's super excited. He's like, this must be it.
The car was registered to a man named Johnny Furr in North Carolina. When Kingston ran him through the system, his address turned out to be fake. Kingston assumed the name was fake too, but through some digging, He learned that Fur happens to be a very common name in a certain part of North Carolina.
And he and another agent are stoked. They're going to drive up to North Carolina. They're going to knock on doors in this very specific part of North Carolina and show pictures of the composite drawings of the shooter, the driver, and the flower buyer. And they're going to just go ask a bunch of questions.
It seemed promising. But when the Georgia FBI office made its request to their office in North Carolina, they were told, in essence, to back off.
And Kingston and his partner are told, sorry, we got it from here. The North Carolina FBI is going to take it. And they kind of didn't do anything with it. And they just sort of dropped it. So that was a huge moment. And nothing really came of it. And months later, Kingston was moved off into, you know, another jurisdiction, another job. And they were kind of back to square one again.
Deb never figured out why the North Carolina field office failed to act on Kingston's lead. And it's unclear what would have happened if they had. Either way, the case ground to a halt. In the meantime, Jim Sullivan was enjoying life as a free man in Palm Beach. But the Leta McClinton case wasn't over. 11 years later, a woman in a small Texas town would walk into her boss's office and tell him a story about her ex-boyfriend. What she said would change everything.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, who the fuck is going to get out of their car and buckhead with a damn ski mask on and then walk up to somebody's door without arousing some suspicion? So I knew that was just total bullshit.
That's next time on Gone South. If you have information, story tips, or feedback you'd like to share with the Gone South team, please email us at gonesouthpodcast@gmail.com. That's gonesouthpodcast@gmail.com. For bonus content, you can follow us on Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram at Gone South Podcast. You can also sign up for our newsletter on Substack at Gone South with Jed Lipinski. Gone South is an Odyssey original podcast. It's created, written, and narrated by me, Jed Lipinski. Our executive producers are Leah Reese-Dennis, Maddie Sprung-Kaiser, and Lloyd Lockridge. Our story editor is Katie Mingle. Gone South is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil. Production support from Ian Mont and Sean Cherry. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, and Hillary Schuff. Thank you for listening to Gone South.